Good afternoon, Regent Radio. This is Ome Sama Rahimtullah bringing you the Horn Report after a few weeks of absence. But today is, like we do always, we would like to be ahead of the news. So we are Wednesday afternoon, and I'm joined on the line by Dr. Gerald Horn. Hello, Dr. Horn.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, and yourself?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, so to start off, you sent me an email and said that you wanted to reflect on Euro-Canadian identity. What is that?
Well, what I mean is this. As you know, I'm a historian, and I'm primarily a historian of the United States, historian of the African experience. But as you also know, I've had occasion to travel to Canada more than once and done research in archives ranging from Ottawa to Toronto to Victoria, British Columbia, much of which is incorporated in the book I wrote, Negro Comrades of the Crown, in which Canada plays a role. And so I've had occasion to think about Canadian history, and I've also had occasion to think about the trajectory of Euro-Canadian identity in particular, since the Euro-Canadians have, shall we say, played a dominant role in Canada's history, at least for the last century. And this is what strikes me, and I'd like to get your opinion. On the one hand, I find that there's a distaste for the United States, justifiably and understandably, on the part of many Euro-Canadians across the board. And sort of proud of the fact that in many ways Canada outstrips the United States, particularly with regard to socioeconomic indices. But at the same time, I also detect this idea that these Euro-Canadians feel that their way of life and their lifestyle, to protect their lifestyle against external threats, whatever those may be, is heavily dependent on the United States and the protection of U.S. imperialism to help to protect Canadian imperialism, which, of course, many of them rarely reflect upon. And so, to me, it leads to a contradiction. On the one hand, a distaste for the United States. On the other hand, a kind of dependence, oftentimes unacknowledged, on the United States. And usually when you have that kind of contradiction, it leads to confusion. It leads to all manner of misjudgments. And so I'm curious to get your reaction as a person who lives in Canada and, as far as I can ascertain, is not Euro-Canadian.
As far as you could ascertain, I do think we've met, you know. I'm not Euro-Canadian by any stretch of the imagination. I might have a confusing history, but definitely not of any Euro origin that I know of. Maybe that's what you were trying to ascertain. But I mean, I think the confusion is the reason for the way that your reflections are, in a sense that it's, first of all, these are two different registers. So that's maybe one way to think about it, that often enough, we don't combine these two registers. So you might think, and I think what you mean is, in a cultural sense, this kind of superiority, but then in a political sense, and I think it is political, or people will understand it as political, that they need the U.S. to survive. But I don't think people are able to bring those two registers together, on the one hand. On the other hand, we might even think of it as a jealousy syndrome, right? You know, to say, you know, to deny the power of the U.S. and Canadian and U.S. history is undeniable, right? So to compensate for that, to say, but we are superior in our socioeconomic status, in our accessibility to, you know, healthcare, education, whatnot. So it might also be a defense mechanism, maybe? What is your kind of take on that contradiction then, since you have reflected on it?
Well, I have to be honest. I'll put my cards face up on the table. I was reading the review of my book, Negro Comrades of the Crown, which, as you know, in the 19th century, I basically salute Canada because it turned against slavery well before the United States did. And that's what I say in the book. And that, the Negroes in the United States, they used to sing these spirituals about following the North Star to Canada, for freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, Canada was self-interested because the British, who were ruling Canada at that time, they felt that they needed a populace, even black people, to keep Canada from being seized by the United States. So that was their interest in that regard. But this Canadian reviewer, Euro-Canadian reviewer, what struck me, I assume this was a patriot, a Canadian patriot of some sort, he was really trying to deny Canada's progressivism, which I found extraordinary. I mean, I don't think he was conservative, because then I was saying, well, even if he was conservative, as a patriot, wouldn't he want to feel superior to the United States?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So it sort of left me a bit befuddled. So then I started thinking about it.
Well, I think on many an occasions we have discussed your disproportionate love for Canada in comparison to the U.S. Slight disillusionment.
In comparison to the United States.
No, and it is relative, right? So then, I mean, I guess for us, we like to think, I mean, there would be no one, I think, no progressive people in Canada that would say that Canada is a good country. We are, especially more and more riddled with increasing inequality, less access to education and healthcare, even more constraining immigration policies. So we see these as really problematic, but not in comparison to the United States, right? We will just take it within, what's going on in our society, right? But then when you think about Canada, you think about it in relation to the States. So I would presume that writer is not incorrect in saying that Canada is not progressive. I don't think it has a progressive history. It has a very colonial history. But when you put that caveat in comparison to the States, then, okay, it makes sense. But I guess maybe this writer was not thinking that way.
Yeah. That's possible.
That would be my take.
You know, as you know, Albert Einstein helped to popularize the idea of the theory of relativity, which he posits as being relevant throughout the universe. And as I say in my 1776 book, which will be out in a few months, it's the question today of these various capitalist societies.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, and I quote, who has the cleanest dirty shirt?
Yeah.
In other words, all the shirts are dirty. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can stipulate that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But for oppressed people, oftentimes we have to make a choice.
Lesser of the
two
evils.
And the choice comes down to who has the cleanest, dirty shirt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Basically.
Yes. No, definitely. And we do, and I think in a day-to-day, in a grounded way, we have to always pick the lesser of the two evils, right? If we choose to vote, for example, right? You choose to vote the lesser of the two, in your case, two evils, in our case, three evils, right? All right, so moving on, the WTO has a new head. It's Robert Carvalho de Azevedo of Brazil. And he is not inheriting, by any stretch of the imagination, an organization that's maybe well-situated. It is definitely riddled with issues. What is your take with this new leadership?
Well, first of all, recall that it was not so long ago, every year, there was a major demonstration whenever the World Trade Organization met. Recall what happened in Seattle in 1999 when thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of people rallied against the WTO. I recall being in Prague, I think it was maybe about a decade ago, in the Czech Republic. And I was, why was there? I can't remember what I was doing in Prague. But I wound up marching with thousands of people against the WTO. Recall that there was a protest in Canada. I think it was in Quebec, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, in Quebec City.
Before or after the Prague march.
And, I think it was around 2001.
I recall when I was in Prague at the anti-WTO march, it reminded me, quite frankly, of what I've read about the Grateful Dead. I don't know if you're familiar with the Grateful Dead. There was this popular band from Northern California.
I've heard of them, yes.
Sort of a hippie band.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a lot of camp followers. And so whenever they traveled, there would be hundreds, if not thousands, of hippies who would follow them wherever they played.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what these anti-WTO protests was reminding me, because people sort of followed the WTO around to protest whatever they, which you know, I understand, you know, fine. I mean, there are worse ways to spend your time. But that whole process apparently has died out. And it's very curious.
It
I mean,
true, yeah.
And it makes one wonder, well, what happened? Because this was just a few years ago. And now the WTO has a new leader. And I should say, parenthetically, that Azevedo, the Brazilian who was elected, that was seen as a slap in the face of the United States because the other candidate was Mexican, and the Mexicans should take a lesson away from this because the Mexicans are now perceived as being too close to the United States. And so voting for the Mexican was seen as a vote for the United States, so he got slapped down. But in any case, back to the main thread, this may sound heretical or blasphemous, but I think I have a book coming out in a few weeks called Black Revolutionary, William Patterson and the Globalization of the African-American Freedom Struggle. And I chose that term globalization consciously and carefully because as I look at the plight of Africans and the United States over the past decades and centuries, there's no question in my mind. If it was just left to these so-called Euro-Americans, we might still be in slavery. I mean, what has helped to rescue us is the global movement. It's globalization. And so when I used to think about globalization and the protests against globalization, and then I know that the leftists who were protesting against what they called corporate-led globalization, which is one of the reasons I participated. But still, some people seem to be against globalization full stop, period. And I think that that may have been a bridge too far because, as I said, I mean, a lot of oppressed people in this country, it's the global struggle that saved us more than the domestic struggle. And I think that that might also shed light on this whole WTO process and what happened. From the halcyon days of thousands marching in Seattle against the WTO to today in 2013, a new leader of the WTO is picked, and I'm sure some of our listeners are wondering, why were you even talking about it?
In terms of, I mean, I think it's interesting that you said that people were protesting against globalization tout court. I mean, I was there in Quebec, right, as well, and not in Seattle, but in Quebec. And I think globalization means one particular thing within protest circles, right? It means capital globalization. It means the globalization of culture and industry. And so I wonder if people were protesting against globalization. It wasn't in the way that you were thinking, just as a side note.
Oh, yeah, of course, of mm-hmm. course, of mm-hmm. course. But mm-hmm. that's the problem with language. That's
yes.
The problem with words.
Exactly.
Is that sometimes we use it's just like, you know, speaking Chinese. I mean, mm-hmm. a word can mean one thing with one tone of voice.
Yeah, yeah.
It can mean something altogether different with another tone of voice. I'm sure I could think of an example in English, too, for that matter.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I think you've raised an important question without maybe offering a tentative answer. Like, why has the protest or the, you know, the fervor against the WTO died down? I mean, I always wondered, is it, I mean, for me, I'm like, I don't go to WTO protests anymore, but I thought it was just like an age thing. Like I just got older and kind of fell out of that kind of activist hippie community. But if it's just not happening on a large scale anymore, do you have a tentative assessment
yeah,
of why
I do.
Not?
I'm glad you asked that question.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is in the early stages, like in 1999 in Seattle, people were interpreting globalization as a U.S. attempt to sort of take over the world. But since 1999, it's clear. as I tell these Euro-Americans here, I mean, you're trying to cut a deal with the Euro-American ruling class against the interests of the rest of us. Hey, the Euro-American ruling class is trying to save its own skin vis-a-vis China. And so since 1999, the world has changed. It's obvious that there's not a unipolar world. There's a multipolar world. I just wrote a letter to the Financial Times. We'll see if they'll print it, where I was commenting on one of their columns, and I pointed out I'd read the Financial Times an article in the China Daily, which is a paper I recommend, by the way. And the article in the China Daily was this. Will China's economy be twice as large as the United States by 2030? It was already assumed that in a few years its economy will be larger. They're talking about its economy being twice as large. So I say all that to say that from 1999, the world has changed, and the idea of globalization being a front for the United States taking over the world, it doesn't carry as much weight. The United States is trying to save its own skin. Mm-hmm. The world has changed. It's a multipolar world. And that's, so I think that's taken the steam out of the anti-corporate-led globalization movement, in my opinion.
I should have known that the explanation would come back to China with you. But, it's a very, when you put it in those words, yes, that makes sense. Globalization means different things. And it's hard if you don't have one kind of target, right? The U.S. And now that, this kind of globalization and global power is maybe a bit more diffused, it becomes a bit more muddied. But speaking of China, the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, is having a 5-day visit in China that I think started on Monday. But he was met with criticism as soon as he got there. The foreign ministry's spokeswoman said that they oppose the use of weapons. They believe in the sovereignty of any country, and it should be respected. And this was responding to the reports that Israel had carried out airstrikes against Syria last weekend. But I think also there are some undertones of the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
Well, Israel, to put my takeaway points first, in some ways has gotten too big for its britches, and to the point where it's compromising its security almost to a laughable degree. Now, what I mean by that is, as you noted, before taking off for Beijing, Prime Minister Netanyahu had bombed Syria, and supposedly to go after missiles being transferred to Hezbollah, the Lebanese resistance movement that fought Israel to a standstill 6 or 7 years ago. And it was felt, in fact, I said this on RT in a clip that you can find on the Radio Regent Saturday Morning Live website, where I told Moscow television that in many ways what Netanyahu had done was a dress rehearsal for a future impending attack on Iran, and which meant that it was very dangerous, and that seemingly Netanyahu is joining forces with the Syrian rebels, who include in their vanguard forces who are married to al-Qaeda, which means that in some ways this is who he's trying to install in Damascus. And it was putting pressure on the United States as well. But he got ahead of himself. Well, one, there's that verbal slapdown in Beijing that was administered to him by the foreign ministry. And then the ultimate slapdown took place just yesterday, Tuesday, when U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, and they agreed to have a peace conference before the end of the month on Syria, probably in Geneva. And I think that this was a recognition on the U.S.'s point that they had to move closer to Moscow's position, which has been clamoring for this peace conference for months now. And, of course, the debate amongst the United States and its North Atlantic allies, including Canada, was not a peace conference, but how do you arm the rebels to drive al-Assad out of power? Now, they've walked back from that position, even though nobody acknowledges that on this side of the Atlantic. They basically surrendered to Moscow's position because, in many ways, the U.S.-Israeli North Atlantic position was incoherent. But what I mean is, did it really make sense to put the al-Nusra Front into power in Damascus, which just announced a wedding with al-Qaeda of Iraq? I mean, I know these people oftentimes don't think things through. That's why they're still bogged down in Afghanistan after supporting the forces that they're now fighting. But this was really just a bridge too far. And I think that Netanyahu in particular needs to be reprimanded, because what the Canadian press won't tell you and what you'll hear on Radio Regent is that even before this trip to China, the Israelis have been accused, quite credibly, of transferring sophisticated military technology from the United States to China. Now, I know that the right wing in Canada is very pro-Israel, but do they support that? I mean, what do you think? Do you think the right wing in Canada supports Israel transferring sophisticated military technology to China? I thought these people thought China, you know, is ruled by communists. They don't like communists. I mean, break this down for me.
I wish I could, but I think there's like definitely a blind support for Israel from the right here in Canada. And I mean, as I think you've mentioned before on these airwaves, Canadians, the right and the left, don't have a very strong analysis of China's increasing geopolitical power on the world scale. So I think that this not only would it be something that they wouldn't mind, it wouldn't even be something that they would think to reflect on.
Well, I guess these people are living a good life. They can't even worry about the future.
But I just... In terms, can you contextualize maybe more China-Israel relations? Like, what is Netanyahu doing in China? What is the
well,
said purpose,
you know,
of this visit?
That's a good question. You know, that's what we need to talk. You know, I've been trying to puzzle it out. I mean, my first impulse was this, that like any other leadership of any other country, the Israelis see that there's this Copernican change in the correlation of forces globally with the rise of China. And so every country basically has to build a bridge to Beijing. Even a country like Israel that heretofore has been seen as the 51st state of the United States of America. But after all, at the end of the day, Israel is a sovereign state. And so they're trying to build a bridge to China. They're trying to butter up Beijing, if you like. And so that helps to shed light on this, except that it's interesting as well, a couple of other data points. One is that the head of the Palestinian state, Mahmoud Abbas, is in Beijing at the same time, and it's felt that that was not a coincidence, that Beijing is trying to take over the mediation role from the United States between the two parties, and certainly they can't do worse in the United States, which is obviously a blind supporter for Israel, so that's probably a step forward. And two, it was just announced that there has been a slowdown in the building of Israeli settlements, which is also shocking and stunning. So I would like to think that, A, Israel recognizes that China's the rising power and they have to get on China's good side, and, B, this leads to more flexibility on the Palestinian question. Now, that's what I would like to think. But that's so contrary to what I've seen in the past few years, I'm reluctant to make an unequivocal declaration to that end.
Well, for now, we'll stick to these good predictions. And it's interesting that you say that Mahmoud Abbas was there at the same time, and that sounds hopeful. So, yeah, as you say, you can't get worse in this United States. So, moving on, you, of course, mentioned Syria. I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to add in terms of a Syrian update.
Well, let's see now. The accusations about chemical weapons flying back and forth. Carla Del Ponte, a United Nations official, pointed the finger of accusation at the rebels in terms of use of chemical weapons. She was promptly reprimanded by the U.S. authorities, and even some of her colleagues in the United Nations pulled the rug out from under her, basically sought to equivocate with regard to what she had said without equivocation. And this was an intriguing sign because it left the impression that the United Nations is being basically sort of bullied by the United States, which of course in one sense is not new. But on the other hand, at a time when the United Nations is going to have to play a leading role in terms of the resolution of the Syrian conflict, it was a very disheartening turn of events. I should also mention there's been a lot of coverage, at least in the U.S. press, about the stepped-up participation of Hezbollah in the Syrian conflict. And Hezbollah, at least in the North Atlantic press, is portrayed as being very close to Iran. The Iranian elections are taking place in a few weeks, and it seemed to me, at least, that the Israeli attack on Syria just a few days ago, as I said, was in many ways a shot over the bow at Iran, seeking to stoke discontent and apprehension in Iran so as to disturb the elections and contribute to the further destabilization of Iran. But in any case, that's about it with regard to Syria.
Okay, and you had mentioned here Nigeria, South Africa. I'm maybe assuming that you meant the various bilateral agreements that were signed between Nigeria and South Africa on Tuesday. Of course, Nigeria and South Africa being the biggest economies on the African continent. You know, what does this say in terms of bilateral, even regional approaches to integration on the continent?
Well, let's first deal with the negative before we get to the positive. There's a bit of competition between Nigeria and South Africa. It's, in many ways, it's reminiscent of the competition between India and China. And we talked about on Radio Regent last week. It was just a few days ago that Indian soldiers and Chinese soldiers were staring at each other eyeball to eyeball over contested terrain on their border. Now, fortunately, there's no border between Nigeria and South Africa. But if there were, they'd probably be in the same position. There's a contestation as to who's going to be the leading power on the continent. And it's interesting that it's expected that within a few years, Nigeria's economy will be substantially larger than South Africa's economy. And also on the negative side, Nigeria is having some real problems in the north with regard to the so-called Boko Haram, which has been fighting the regime and has been blowing up churches, attacking military, and in return, the military has been running amok in northern Nigeria, which is very troubling. That is to say, the military is just sort of arresting in a willy-nilly, random way men, young men, who are Muslim, and oftentimes killing them, believe it or not. I mean, it's quite astonishing what's happening in northern Nigeria, and that's a very disturbing sign that does not bode well for the future security of Nigeria, because people have long memories about this sort of thing. Now, on the positive side, as you noted, there are these agreements between Nigeria and South Africa. It bodes well for economic integration of SADC, the Southern African Development Community, and ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States. And both Nigeria and China have, excuse me, Nigeria and South Africa have very close relations with both China and Brazil and India and Russia to a degree. And that's good news because that sets the stage for further integration of the Nigerian and South African economies and ultimately the economies of West Africa and South Africa. So that's the good news.
Okay, and in the maybe 2 minutes that we have left, you wanted to talk about the elections that took place in Malaysia on Sunday, but in, I guess, in protest to that, 40,000 supporters of the Malaysian opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim had gathered to protest in Kuala Lumpur, saying that there was cheating and that the elections or the election victory to the long-ruling Barisan Nasional Coalition was, you know, won by fraud. What are your kind of thoughts on this election?
Well, Malaysia, as you know, is a Southeast Asian nation, a population of about 25 to 30 million, a close neighbor of both Singapore and Indonesia, formerly colonized by the British, a population that's about two-thirds indigenous Malay, but a huge population of Chinese origin, about 20 to 25%, and they're dominant in intellectual and business circles, which is the case, quite frankly, with a good deal of Southeast Asia, certainly with regard to the Philippines and Indonesia, where the intellectual and business elites tend to be of Chinese origin. And there hangs the tale, because there's been a fair amount of tension between the Malay and the Chinese populations. Interestingly enough, Anwar Ibrahim, who is the opposition leader, of course, is Malay, and he was in this rather motley coalition that not only included people who were just opposed to the ruling party, which has been in power since 1957, believe it or not. But the Ibrahim Coalition also included a lot of so-called Muslim fundamentalists who are opposed to what they perceive to be the secular nature of the ruling party. And the coalition also included a good number of Chinese as well, even though if these so-called fundamentalists gain an influence, they'll be sharpening their knives, quite frankly, to come after the Chinese. I mean, that's what happened in Indonesia, you might recall, just a few years ago when you had these terrible pogroms against the Chinese-Indonesian population. So that's a very curious development. But part of the problem is that the opposition, and particularly the Chinese, they don't like the affirmative action policies, the positive discrimination policies that tend to benefit the indigenous Malays in terms of education, spots in universities, in terms of business, not unlike the positive discrimination and affirmative action policies that India pursues with regard to those who are referred to as either Dalits or untouchables, or affirmative action positive discrimination that's pursued thus far in the United States with regard to women of whatever national origin, and, of course, people of African descent, Latinos, Native Americans, et cetera. And so I'm not sure if this was a wise move on the part of these Chinese Malaysians who voted the way they did, but that's what happened. And it's going to be a very interesting situation to watch because, as you noted, the opposition is claiming fraud. They've been rallying thousands. Anwar Ibrahim, of course, used to be part of the ruling party, but he fell out with Mahathir Muhammad, the longtime leader. Mahathir charged him, in fact, with sodomy and put him on trial. It was a very ugly development, very ugly turn of affairs. He was acquitted. But in any case, I think Malaysia is going to be in pins and needles in the next few days at least.
Great, Gerald. It was really nice to talk to you this week after a few weeks of break, but I'm sure you enjoyed talking to Norman. But we will definitely link up with you, myself or Norman, next week. Thank you very much again for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Regent.
The voice of your community.
In the spirit of the Black Panthers, in the spirit of Asada Shakur, we make this movement towards freedom for all those who have been oppressed and all those in the struggle. Yeah, check it. There were lights and sirens, gunshots fine. Cover your eyes as I describe a scene so violent. Seemed like a bad dream. She laid in the blood puddle, blood bubbled in her chest. Cold air brushed against open flesh. No room to rest. Pain consumed these breaths. Shot twice with her hands up. Police questioned, but shot before she answered. One panther lost his life, the other ran for his. Scandalous the police were as they kicked and beat her. Comprehension, she was beyond trying to hold on to life. She thought she lived with no arm, that's what it felt like. Got to the hospital, eyes held tight. They moved the room to room, she could tell by the light. Handcuffed tight to the bed, through her skin they bit. With guns to her head, every word she got hit. Who shot the trooper, they asked her. Put mace in her eyes, threatened to blast her. Her mind raced till things got still. Opened her eyes, realized she's next to her best friend who got killed. She got chills as they told her that's what she would be next. Hurt mixed with anger, survival was a reflex. They lied and denied visits from a lawyer. But she was building as they tried to destroy her. If it wasn't for this German nurse, they would have served the worst. I read the sister's story, knew that it deserved a verse. I wonder what would happen if that would have been me. All of this just so we could be free, so dig it, y'all. Awakened up, walkie-talkies crackling, not saying where they taking her. Though she kinda knew what made the ride peaceful was the trees and the sky was blue.
Arrived to Middlesex prison about 6 in the morning. Uneasy as they pushed her to the second floor in a cell. One cot, no window facing hell. Put in the basement of a prison with all males and the smell of misery. Seedless toilets and centipedes. She exercised, paint, and began to read. 2 years in the hole, her soul grew weak. Away from people so long she forgot how to speak. She discovered freedom is an unspoken sound. And a wall is a wall can be broken down. Found peace in the Panther. She went on trial with one of the brothers. She had a child with the foulness. They wouldn't feed her, hoping she'd lose her seed. Held tight, knowing the fight would live through the sea. In need of a doctor, from her stomach she'd bleed. Out of this situation, a girl was deceived. Separated from her, left to mother the revolution. And lactate to attack hate. Cause federal estate was built for a black fate. Her emptiness was filled with beatings and court dates. They fabricated cases, hoping one would stick. And said she robbed places that didn't exist. In the midst of threats on her life and being caged with Aryan whites. Through dark halls of hate, she carried the light. I wonder what would happen if that would have been me. All of this just so we could be free. Yeah, I often wonder what would happen if that would have been me. All of this just so we could be free. So dig it, people.
I'm thinking of a side.
Her grandmother would bring news that she had a dream. Her dreams always meant what they needed them to mean. What made them real was the action in between. She dreamt that Asada was free in their own house in Queens. The fact that they always came true was the thing. Asada had been convicted of a murder she couldn't have done. Medical evidence shown she couldn't have shot the gun. It's time for her to see the sun from the other side. Time for a daughter to be by her mother's side. Time for this beautiful woman to become soft again. Time for her to breathe and not be told how or when. She untangled the chains and escaped the pain. Broke out of prison, I could never explain. And even to this day, they try to get to her, but she's free with political asylum in Cuba.
Freedom. I'll be honest with you. I know a whole lot more about what freedom isn't than about what it is. Because I've never been free. I can only share my vision with you for the future about what freedom is. The way I see it, freedom is the right to grow. It's the right to blossom. Freedom is the right to be yourself, to be who you are, to be who you want to be.